Acts chapter 12. Let's look at Acts chapter 12 and verse 5. You may remember from Acts chapter 12, verses 1 through 4, that Herod has done what to who? Anybody remember the relatively, I'm going to say famous, he would have been famous in that day and time, person? All right, James has died. And how did James die? He died by the sword. And now who has Herod turned his attention to? Peter. All right, you have this feast, the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, that was 7 days long. At the end of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, you've got the Passover period. We talked about Herod being someone who was very cunning, just like some of today's politicians. And he, from what we can tell, seems to have thought that we'll go ahead and let the 8 days pass. A lot of people will be in town. Perhaps they'll stay even longer. And then I'll really give them something to feast upon, so to speak. And that's going to also be the death, the execution of Peter. That brings us to Acts chapter 12 and verse 5. Peter, therefore, notice the concluding word. Peter, therefore, was kept in the prison. But prayer was made earnestly of the church unto God for him. You have the imperfect tense being used here. Peter was kept in prison, ongoing action. We would expect that. But as Peter is in prison, what's the church, the congregation, doing? Fellow Christians, they are praying. What do you think the tense there is? One-time action or ongoing? Ongoing. So that's an interesting picture. On the one hand, Peter is in prison. On the other hand, you have God's people, they're praying, continuous action. And how are they praying for Peter? They're praying earnestly. One source said that these Christians threw themselves into the work of intercession. Now, I like that statement. They threw themselves into the work of intercession on the account of Peter. I think that we'd like that today, wouldn't we? You're imprisoned. Things are not looking well. You're going to go to trial. You're sick. Need a job. And you would appreciate fellow Christians coming to God on a regular basis, throwing themselves in intercession for you. Source went on to say this was no silent, sleepy prayer meeting. You think there have been a few of those over the years? A silent, sleepy prayer meeting? Some worship services too, but that was not like this. And we'll see, I think, get some indications as we go further down through this, the time of day. And that's also significant. Now, what were these Christians praying for when it came to Peter? They're praying a lot. Where do you find that in the text? All right, that's a possibility, isn't it? It's not specifically telling us what they were praying for, but that very well could be the right answer. They might have been praying for his release. I think the prayers probably had to include that as well. Maybe they wanted the release, but they end that with whatever your will is. Anything else? Stan?
Well, it may be possible that they were praying that Peter would be able to withstand the trial.
All right. I don't think that's probably going to be the most common answer, but that's a very good answer. That, you know, we talked about this in our last class, that if you go back into the earlier chapters of Acts, remember, two big points. Peter's with some company. The other apostles are with him. And also those prior imprisonments, Peter is there for just a short time, basically overnight. Now he's there for, if not the whole 8 day period, roughly a week. So probably at least 5 days. So yes, let Peter withstand this and, you know, not fail. Glenda?
Well, the angel came and released him, but they were probably, because Peter was chained and bound, they were probably, and he opened the door to the church, so he was focused, but they didn't want to.
Yeah. I'm going to pick up on that point a little bit later, but you hit on something that's really important, a very significant point, but we're just going to put that in the back burner for now, but a great point. They also may have been, in addition to what we said, been praying for his protection. We're not told where the special prayer services were held, but we do see that first century Christians, they saw the value of prayer and especially of earnest prayer. Stan and I have talked about this a little bit. I'm going to bring it up again to let the class toss it around for a little bit. Ray?
Back in the fifth chapter, we noticed that Peter was released from prison once before in the night. Prayers, things. And so they may be doing the very same thing again.
Sure, they knew that God could do that. You are also in the area of Jerusalem here, and that information was probably not new to these people. When the text says they prayed earnestly, you have to be careful about implications sometimes, because a person can make a statement and you can draw wrong conclusions about it. But when they prayed earnestly, could that possibly imply something? If this was earnest prayer, then there may be prayer which is not so intense. What about the person who decides, I'm going to pray before I go to sleep tonight? Oh God, one, two, three. You think that ever happens to somebody? Sure. How earnest do you think those prayers are? They might. I think they're probably sincere. But if they were really earnest, they might have been tried at an earlier time in the day. Rather than, you know, I'm already half asleep and I'm going to go ahead and, you know, kind of get in another quick thought or two before I head off to night-night land. So, huh? Okay, there could be that. We think about earnestness as far as prayer posture. Sometimes that can go ahead and be an indication of intensity. But these people, they were very, very earnest, very, very passionate about the prayer. So Jesus, it brings to mind, in my mind, one of his teachings. Remember over there in Luke chapter 18, verses 1 through 7, he talks about the widow. And who is the other character in the story? There is the judge. And is the is the judge, at least initially, disposed to answer the widow's prayer? No. But finally, the widow goes and goes and goes, and the judge finally sort of throws up his hands and says, enough. You have come to my door all these times, and now I'm ready to go ahead and answer your request. And Jesus said, God is not like that in the sense that you have to wear him down, but that persistence does matter. Anything that you want to add or ask before we look at Acts 12:6? Gary and then Stan.
In King James, it doesn't say earnestly. It says without ceasing.
Okay. Yeah, there is a difference as far as the original text. Some manuscripts have an adjective, some manuscripts have an adverb, and that may account for why the translation difference is there, depending on which version you have. But also, fervently, without ceasing, even though you have a slight difference in the manuscripts, the same basic word is used. It's just a different form. So they are trying to communicate that this was something that was ongoing and it was habitual activity. So thank you for pointing that out. Stan?
Right along with that same discussion is basically what I was going to say, but it is interesting that the King James uses without ceasing, which would indicate to us today that means ongoing, continuously ongoing, whereas the word earnestly, which is in the American Standard Version, means with the intensity, with the fervency, as you say. So it has the two different aspects of what prayer can be.
I mentioned this at the last preacher's meeting. I don't think I mentioned this in class. If I did, stop me. But when I was at Fried Hartman, there was an older preacher. He's 80-plus. He's been in the area for a number of years. And they were going to have a prayer session for the speakers that day and for the week's events. That sound familiar to anybody? Okay. I think it was just a preacher's meeting. I used this illustration. So they said to the people that were in the area where I was, they were just trying to grab a handful of people, they said, would you come back and at least be in the little session that we're going to have, and if you want, you can go ahead and also include a prayer request, or you can pray. So anyway, I went back with that early morning group, and before they got to the praying, this older preacher said, I've been thinking about praying without ceasing for a number of years. And he said, my wife, he's remarried, first wife died, he said, my wife has cancer of this type. And he said, it has finally dawned on me as far as what that expression over in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 means. This doesn't sound familiar to anybody. Okay, all right. I thought you were a fresh group, so very good. Well, after the prayer, I just wanted to double check. So anyway, he said, the first thing that comes to my mind when I get up, first thought that goes through my mind is my sick wife. Her cancer. And he said, the first thing that goes through my mind is a prayer to God. And he said, as I go through the day, my wife is on my mind. He said, I pray for her throughout the day before I go to sleep. At least that's my habit. What I try to do is I pray for her and her cancer, that she can be healed of that before I go to sleep. He said, that experience has, in my mind, given me a better understanding of what it means to pray without ceasing. And that was sort of how he prefaced this prayer meeting. Now, I brought that back home with me and shared that with the preacher's meeting because I thought, here's a fellow who's been thinking about that for about 60 years, and it took him several decades to finally come to a good understanding of that, and maybe that was not the best ideal that most ideal way to come to an understanding of that, but still, I thought that is a great illustration when you're talking about praying without ceasing. It's not that 24/7, and I think most people understand that practically, but somebody says, well, what does it then mean? And that's another way of going at it, Stan, the point that you were just making. It is on the mind throughout the day. It is so prominent, it's so important that this is something that is put before God several times a day. So you can get some value as far as contrasting or comparing those two translations, but also this is something that people literally do persist in 7 days a week. Any other thought on that point? Stan, and then we'll take Ray's point.
Well, question, and I agree absolutely with what you just said. In my past experience, in my thinking about praying without ceasing, I have thought that it was an admonition to be in continuous contact with God. Now, whether it was about one thing or not, no, not necessarily, but it could be as you go through the day, okay, Lord, I'm going to be doing this, and I would like to be with me in this. And then that's all done. You're going to something else, and that you're, but that you're constantly got God in mind with your activities. Now, is that appropriate?
Yes. Now we're switching gears a little bit. Now instead of talking about I'm focused on a single person, in this case the preacher and his wife, you're now taking that to, I don't know that I want to say in the next level, but you're now introducing some other things. For example, you go through life and 10 good things happen to you today. You had a policeman behind you and, you know, you didn't have a yellow light that you had to run. Somebody says, whew, man, might have had a ticket. Well, maybe so. You think it might be appropriate to thank God for that?
Yeah.
All right. I mean, you were blessed. You're not going to have to pay the $100 fine or whatever it might be. And then you head down a little further and, you know, you find that there is a wreck just in front of you, just behind you. You're still in your vehicle. And you were just seconds away from being involved in that car accident. And you think, wow, how fortunate I was. Well, that's true. I mean, had you been a couple seconds this way or a couple seconds that way, that would have been you. Once again, can you be grateful to God for that? Sure. And there are a lot of little things that come up, and I think maybe the older you get, the more sensitive, I'm not saying you're old, but the older you get, the more sensitive you become to those things, that this was good, and whatever the cause of it, God's providence, or if this is the way just that things happen to fall today, I'm thankful. You know, that we were safe when we were able to come to and from services in bad weather, whatever it was. You know, I got to the doctor's office, and I didn't have to wait 45 minutes like I thought. They had a cancellation, and they just brought me right in. Could you be thankful to God for that? You've got some extra time. The car bill, as far as the repair, you were expecting it to be twice as much, and that turns out not to be the case. Can you say, God, I'm thankful for that? Yes. And if you can train yourself to do that kind of thing, number one, I think you're on the right road biblically. But number two, you open up that communication with line, that communication line with God, to a much greater degree. And once you start widening that, it really helps in a lot of different ways. So I would say yes, that's also very consistent with what you find in 1 Thessalonians 5.
Well, one of the things that might help if people haven't gotten to that point yet, and it may just be me, I don't know, but I talk from my experiences. There are times when God seems to be an independent entity and not a part. Not like you and I are standing right here talking. I can see you. I can, if I want to, I can come up. I can feel you're there. We're talking. I know what your attitude is, and I know what you're feeling, et cetera, et cetera. But when we talk to God, we don't get that idea, and therefore we think, well, God's not close to me. He's not here. If we would get it in our minds that God is actually within us, a part of us, I don't have to go anywhere to talk to him. I don't have to actually, in that respect, you're separated from me. But if we think in terms of God's right here, he's a part of my life, all I need to do is just
reach out.
reach out.
Yeah, that's true. Tied in with that, let's go back to what you're talking about for a moment ago as far as that in-person communication. You never know what mood I'm going to be in. I might be really anxious to talk to you. On the other hand, on another day, you might be the last person in the world that I want to talk to you. Well, no, really, I mean true. You never know as far as, and that might be not because I think you're a bad person, but because I'm sick. I don't want to talk to anybody. Doesn't matter that you or, you know, wife, whoever it might be. So people can be changeable. Sometimes you're fickle, sometimes circumstances are not good. But when we remember, God doesn't change. Remember James chapter 1, he is without variation. So if you understand God's character and the point that you added, that he's always there, part of his unchangeable nature, always willing to have people reach out to him, all of a sudden you think, well, hey, you know, he's like that solid rock. And whenever I reach out, his nature is always going to be the same. He always wants to hear. He's always interested in helping those who love him and want to serve him and so forth. And he's not like other people. Now, you can find some people who are almost always like this, that, and the other way, but there's no guarantee that they're going to be like that in every set of circumstances. So great points. Ray, let's jump over to you for a second.
What Stan was saying there, Paul, on many occasions when he was writing to the different churches, he said, always I'm praying for you. The same kind of words there that we see here, you're thinking about here. So with Paul, he had all these different congregations on his mind, but he was praying for everybody or every church constantly. He wouldn't get done in 24 hours. And so what I'm saying is it's on his mind. Today he might mention one, tomorrow he might mention a different one. And we do the same thing in our prayers. Whether we're praying for the membership here, we're praying for our family when we're home or whatever. It's always there, maybe in the background a little bit. But we understand that we are still praying for this bunch of people.
Sure, and when you take all those thoughts that we've brought out as far as class discussion thus far, and you think about 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, that's really what Paul's trying to drive at there. Right. And if we can direct our minds in that kind of way, then you'll be headed in that direction. Anybody else?
Yes.
Okay.
One more.
Okay.
How do you know that fine's $100?
I don't know. That was just a random figure. May have gone up or down. Acts 12, verse 6. And when Herod was about to bring forth the same night, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and guards before the door kept the prison. All right, so you have Peter, the night before he's supposed to be brought out, he's sleeping between how many soldiers? Two. Now, probably not the best thing to have as far as a sleeping environment, but it probably was a little bit worse than just that. What else is said about Peter?
Chains.
Now, what do you think those chains were like? When we think about chains, you go down to the hardware store, is every chain the same? No. At one end of the spectrum, what might the chain be like? All right, small, thin. I mean, it doesn't take very much. I mean, you might not be able to do anything with your hands, but you get a pair of pliers, and you can easily take the links, and if not squeeze them together, you can probably break them. And then on the other end of the spectrum, what do you find as far as chains? Yeah, you think about the big ocean liners, and you've got the chains out there with the anchors and so forth. What do you think the chains would have been like for Peter?
Somewhere between those two.
Somewhere between those two. It would not, certainly would not have been the lightest kind of chain. And there were a couple of reasons for that. Chains, just like handcuffs. If you've ever seen a show where police put handcuffs on people, or if you've ever played with handcuffs, do you find that there's some flexibility there as far as how far you can tighten a cuff? Yeah. I mean, you can have it so loose that the person can almost slip out of the cuff. And then you can have it tight enough where the person obviously is not able to slide it past that wrist area and get it over the hand. But then, if you want to inflict some pain, what do? You really cinch it down, and then it's to the point where it's cutting into the skin. And sometimes they did that with chains in ancient times. You went and you tightened the chain enough. You bound the hands, you bound the feet to the point where it was something like a torture device. Now, there was something else. You've seen the old movies as far as you've got the prisoner, he's out there with the chain, it's attached to the ball. Why do that?
You get very far
away. All right, you're not going to run very far, so if you've got a fairly heavy chain on you, even if you escape, I mean, don't expect to saw through it or anything in our time, let alone that time, but it's heavy, you're probably not going to escape. But what else, though?
Well, he didn't have his clothes on.
Well, we'll talk about that. So let's come back to that. Anything else? Well, there's that. You've got the noise factor. Anything else?
Restricted his movements.
There's that. Anybody remember the old Andy Griffith show, Barney? He had to get weighed in for the, let's see, how'd that go? There was a police examination, and you had to meet certain criteria, and Barney wasn't going to meet the criteria because he was underweight. And it was just before they went, and Andy came up with an idea. Anybody remember what the idea was? Yeah, very good. You know, he had his dog tags or whatever it was, and they went down to the hardware store, and they got like a 10-pound chain. And I think when they go to the examining station, the guy's looking at Barney thinking, you're going to be underweight. But he gets on the scale, and hey, you're okay, you're heavy enough. And then I think they went out, and then they had a little conversation, and they open up Barney's shirt, and he's got this 10-pound chain, and yep, you got to have a chain for the dog tags. Well, they didn't specify how heavy the chain had to be. Now, I use that illustration for this reason. Can you imagine Barney, or any cop, or a soldier, running around with a 10-pound chain for his dog tags? Well, certainly that's going to be pretty secure, isn't it? But why don't you do that? Why don't the cops? You're running around with a 10-pound chain. What's that going to do to you after a few hours? You're going to wear you out. Well, what do you think that was designed to do with prisoners? All right, you're going to drag that chain. You're going to be tired. And now think how long Peter's been in jail. About a week. Everywhere he goes, he's got to lug that chain. What do you think is going to be true of him after he gets to the end of the week? He's going to be worn out. So he's positioned between these two soldiers, and what's he doing? He's sleeping. Not because that's the most comfortable place to spot, but I suspect he's asleep for what reason? He's exhausted. He is tired. You have those chains around your hands, and you are probably going to be whipped. Now, there may be another reason. Peter, an old man or still a younger guy at this point? Well, he is getting older. All right, he's probably middle-aged, but not an old man. Let's take a look at what Jesus had to say to this same guy, John chapter 21, verses 18 and 19. John 21, verses 18 and 19. Who wants to read it for us in a minute? John 21, 18 and 19. Ray, you ready to go?
Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were younger, you used to gird yourself and walk wherever you wish. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will gird you and bring you where you do not wish to go.
All right, if Peter was maybe 30-ish when he started up with Jesus, Jesus is about 3 years, he's probably hit at least the age of 40 right now, and I don't think he probably would have seen himself as old. If he's in prison, and he thinks back to what Jesus told him, John 21, verses 18 and 19, he's thinking, well, the Lord doesn't lie. And Jesus said, I'm going to die when I reach what point in life? I'm going to die when I am an old man. Now, here things don't look good. Been in prison for about a week, and I'm still here. I've been praying. I'm sure that was true for Peter. He probably assumed that other Christians had been praying, and yet he's still in prison. And he knows that he's about to be, probably within hours of being brought out of the prison cell. And he's got a pretty good idea what Herod and these other Jews want for him. But yet, I think he's probably matured to the point as well where if he thinks back to John chapter 21, he said, the Lord said, I'm not going to die until I'm old. And I'm not old. So whatever happens, I've got faith in God. So part of it could have been the exhaustion from the chains. But I'm also thinking that part of it was Peter's faith. And he said, this is what the Lord promised. I believe, I've got faith, and somehow I'm going to be delivered. So I can't prove that, but I do know what Jesus promised him, and I do know that Peter certainly had the ability to think back on that and remember it. Anything that you want to add or ask before we look at verse 7, Acts 12? Okay. Verse 7 says, and behold, an angel of the Lord stood by him, and a light shined in the cell. And he, that's an angel, smote Peter on the side and awoke him, saying, rise up quickly. And his chains fell off his hands. Herod had locked Peter up, and he'd been successful in that venture for about a week, and yet God breaks this apostle out of jail, out of prison, with an angel. Now, we're not given the time, an exact time, for Peter's unexpected release, but you do know from verse 18 that it was sometime before daybreak, and as you start looking at the time of Peter's release, it was ideal. If Peter had escaped at an earlier time, why might that have been a problem?
There would have been more people around.
Okay, and with those people, that would have given, I think, Herod and the soldiers more time to search. That could have been certainly an issue. He could have launched an intensive search and maybe put Peter back in jail. And then two, what about an explanation? We see this sometimes with politicians. Something comes up, maybe from their history, it's very unfavorable, and they're called on to give an explanation, and they sort of stumble and fumble. But after they have a week, what happens? They can get their story together, and then, well, here's really what happened. You know, we can clarify it now. Well, that's not really clarification. You've come up with a better answer. And Herod certainly could have had the chance to come up with a better answer had Peter escaped at an earlier time. But this guy escapes just before you're ready to have him released, end of the Passover, and you really don't have much time to come up with either a good search or a good explanation. Could God have sent more than one angel? He could have sent a bunch had he wanted that. What was the name of this angel? We're not told. It doesn't say. About the only detail that we have is that there was this light in Peter's cell. We don't know the source of that light. Maybe it was a miraculous source. That's possible. But you remember there over in Luke chapter 2 and verse 9, same writer, angels, when they show up, there seems to be plenty of light there. So maybe that's a good cross-reference. It certainly was sufficient to illuminate the room. It's been suggested that Peter was sleeping soundly because the angel smote his side. Once again, I think that's a reasonable conclusion. The blow was sufficient to wake up or rouse Peter. And the angel said to what? I want you to get up. I want you to start moving. The idea there is moving quickly. Do not delay. Now, what do you think Peter might have been told? Don't delay. Don't. Well, it was that. Anything else?
What did she say?
It's time to go. Anything else?
All
right, I think that you have, sometimes when you wake a person out of sound sleep, the house is on fire. What? Who? Huh? I don't know what's going on. And it takes a little while to kind of figure out, somebody's coming through the window or the door, get up. I'm just not quite sure what you're telling me. So it does sometimes take a little while for us to begin registering things, and maybe that was also true for Peter. We do know after Peter is woken up, the things that took place, we have a good sequence of events. He says what happened with the chains. Remember, we suspect that they were fairly heavy. They fell off. That's kind of amazing. So this was not something that you get from Walmart that was El Cheapo. This was a good product. The angel didn't need to saw the chains. The angel did not need to find a key for the chains. It's interesting to me that as you look at something from a slightly different perspective, remember over there in the book of Luke, this is not the only time that we find this, but in Luke chapter 8 and verse 29, demonics, the people who had been possessed by Satan, they had some chains on them. And the Bible says that those chains didn't always stay on them. Why not? They broke them. What do you think about the strength of those chains? Again, the Walmart cheapo, or you think that they were probably pretty sturdy? I mean, you want to bind a demonic, somebody who can do some damage, you're probably going to use some of the sturdiest chains that you have. So it's maybe difficult for us to imagine that a person who has been infected, if you will, with a demon, possessed by a demon, that they had the ability to simply break the chains. Now, whether or not they had to work at that for a while or whether or not that was immediate, that's not specifically stated. But if demonics had the power to break chains, then you would think an angel, especially an angel that was on this mission from God to free Peter, that certainly was not going to be any problem for him.
And the demonic strength could be kind of like an adrenaline surge or something.
That could be too. There are some pieces of information that we don't have about that. But saying that angels would have had any difficulty with this, when you look at Luke chapter 8 and verse 29, that just doesn't register very well. It's not surprising that the angel had that power. The word which is translated fall off, that's a verb. It's also used to describe the falling from grace in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 4. Now, I find that to be an interesting thought, because when you think about the chains falling off, what does that mean? They were still hanging on a little bit? They were completely separated. So when Paul uses that same word over in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 4, you're fallen from grace, unless it's a different meaning there. Sometimes words can have more than one sense or more than one meaning. But unless that's the case, and that doesn't appear to be true, what's then true? If you're fallen from grace, the chains have fallen off. Falling from grace means that you are severed from God, no longer in a right relationship with God. Anything that you want to discuss before we look at Acts 12, 8 to 10? Steve?
Yeah. Just waking up. of a sudden chains fall off, we have to tell him right away, this is from God. So.
Can you imagine even a jailbreak today, or prison break? If somebody showed up in your cell and you're tired and half asleep and somebody says, hey, we're busting out. I think even today people would sort of, you know, what? I don't understand what's taking place. And we don't have a lot of time to discuss this. We need to go. And if that were an angel, surely that would only intensify things, even if you'd seen the miraculous. So it had to be quite an experience for Peter.
Peter also had been at the tomb when it had seen the angels and the light around the angels. So when the angel spoke to him and was a light, he probably immediately recognized that, hey, this is an angel.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Cornelius too. When you start looking at his involvement with angels over a decade, it was 10 plus years. So we don't know how many times angels had some kind of interaction with him, but there were certainly enough where he doesn't at this point seem frightened by it. It's more, I need to kind of figure out what's taking place. But those previous experiences were certainly helpful.
If we continue on down here a couple more verses like you're talking about, he still, at that time, would have thought it was still part of a vision.
Mm-hmm.
But he's right about him seeing things over the period of time with Cornelius and things, seeing a whole new opening to the gospel to a group of people.
Yeah. So you can be familiar with something, but still, that doesn't necessarily mean that the next time something similar happens, it's going to be immediately clear. And that was certainly true for Peter. Is that it? Glenda? Yeah, it's clear that when light shows up in Scripture, unless the devil's trying to imitate something, you're being pointed to the power of God, especially deliverance. And we're going to see a little bit more with that as far as the word delivered here in just a bit. Okay, let's pick up. We've got about 7 minutes left. Let's pick up with verses 8 to 10. The story continues, and the angel said unto him, gird thyself, and bind on thy sandals. And he did so. And he saith unto him, cast thy garment about thee, and follow me. And he went out and followed, and he knew not that it was true, which was done by the angel, but thought he saw a vision. Verse 10. And when they were past the first and the second guard, they came unto the iron gate that leadeth into the city, which opened to them of its own accord. And they went out and passed on through the street, and straightway the angel departed from him. Peter's hands are now free. Verse 7. That had to be a big blessing to him. Peter's told to put on his shoes and get dressed. Now, Betty made the point earlier that you may look at this and think that he didn't have on any clothing. That's one possible explanation, but it's also helpful, I think, to remember how people dressed in this day and time. Remember, you've kind of got these long, flowing clothes, and you see this by Paul as he talks about Peter, too. He talks about girding up the loins. Remember that word, gird? So for these people, they would have a belt, and you would cinch that belt around you and kind of stuff things in and stuff things together. And it's also possible that's what's taking place here. Put on the shoes and go ahead and gird your loins, gather up your clothes and stuff things together and tighten that belt, because we're going to go on a trip, on a journey. So I think there's maybe a little more favor for that view because of what you find elsewhere in the New Testament, but I don't know that we could be definitive about that. So he's getting dressed. Peter did that with at least two guards in the cell. Remember, he was sleeping between two of them. You also have two guards outside his cell. We see that in verse 6. And how those guards were willing or unable to stop Peter is simply not stated. The two most likely possibilities in my mind would be that they were, I don't know, people talk about putting somebody on ice. Somehow they were either incapacitated to the point where they couldn't see what was taking place, or it's also possible that they were somehow incapacitated and they sort of watched. You see sometimes victims, they'll say, I watched the person do this, that, or the other thing, but it didn't feel like I could do anything. I just felt like I was frozen in time. And maybe that's what happened with these fellows. They were able to see. I like that view a little bit better. I don't have any evidence for it, but I like that view a little bit better, because when Herod begins to ask at a later time, the guards are interrogated, it seems to me that that would be a very interesting testimony, a very interesting report to say, well, there was this creature that showed up, probably an angel, And it freed Peter, and we were not able to move. Now, maybe that wouldn't have been the best report to give to Herod. Maybe he would have been convinced if they would have said, we simply don't know what happened, and he would have assumed that was the power of God. I don't know. But we do know that the guards, verse 19, were examined, and that was taking place not long after Peter was found to be missing from his cell. Anything you want to add or ask about that point? Tim?
It says there was two chains and two guards, and it was common place then that guards that were placed over a prisoner, if that guard let that prisoner get away, that guard had to suffer the same consequences the prisoner had. If he was going to be in prison for 10 years, the guard would be in prison for 10 years. If he was going to suffer death, the guard would suffer death. I kind of think that those chains were probably fastened on one end to the guard.
Yeah.
Peter. And the angel loosened those chains in such a way that those guys didn't wake up. They, you know, and they probably, he probably had a lot of fear when they woke up and he wasn't there.
Yes, they did. They did. And you bring up an interesting point as far as Peter being chained to the guards. You wonder what happened to the chains. At least I do. When the chain was released from Peter, did that mean that the chain that bound Peter was loosed, but the cuff, if you will, was still attached to the two guards? Now, if that's the way it worked, that would really be fascinating. Or it's also possible that the chain was released from both the guards and Peter. So I'm not sure which might have been more compelling or which way the angel decided to go. But when you think about what was taking place, that had to be a pretty amazing thing. The guards wake up and, you know, they're still there and healthy. It's not like somebody conked them and they're bleeding, or it's not like they're, you know, bruised and battered. But, yeah.
Well, that would have been even more mysterious to them that somebody could loosen those chains and they didn't feel it, they didn't hear it. You know, I mean, they woke up and he was gone and they still had him on them.
Yeah, and if the chains were still there, it's kind of like, how did they, I don't know, get him loose? I mean, it's not like they were passing around handcuff keys. You have the statement that they were like dead men.
Yeah, and so that could be the same thing here.
Yeah, yeah. Now, were they in a state where they were unable to see and hear and remember anything? Or were they simply in a state where they were frozen, they were unable to move, but they were still able to see and hear and remember and eventually... Yeah, and that's a question that, like I say, is an interesting question, but one that we can't get an answer to here as far as what they may have saw and recorded. But you would think that with Herod's interest in this, that God may have allowed them to see and remember and then later be able to recount that this was some creature, an angel that delivered him. That certainly would have, I think, lent more credibility to the gospel rather than maybe try to conclude there were some people who broke in. There's no indication that Herod tried to say there was a big break-in by people. Christians came to get him and so forth. But if you're being told an angel came and let him out, that's going to be a tough sell to try to explain. Let's see if we've got some more information for the last couple minutes that we do have. Peter did as the angel commanded him. You see that in verse 9. He did not immediately realize that his escape was real. So the end of verse 9 says he thought, that's imperfect tense, he was continuing to think that he saw a vision. Now, I find that statement intriguing because it tells us, at least on this occasion, that for the people who had visions, what did it seem like? It seemed like it was real. Anybody ever have a dream they thought it was real? I mean, you thought it wasn't just a dream, but you thought, I am actually here and this is taking place and this is not a dream. Well, if you can call to mind some of those experiences or the next time you have one of those dreams, that may give you a better illustration of what visions were like. They seem like real life events. And Peter may have been thinking that the vision was going to end, and once that vision ended, what was going to happen to him? He'd wake up and where'd he be? He'd be back in the prison cell. So that was an exciting dream. It was a great vision, but here I am. That was not to be.